Jewish Audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad, South London, England.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the next part in our history series. And this evening, I'm going to move through the period of the Hasmoneans, from just after the Hanukkah story until the period of Herod. In fact, I had intended to go through to the destruction of the Second Temple. Let me just give you a few dates to, again, give parameters. And that is that the story of Hanukkah, the victory of Hanukkah, and the miracle of Hanukkah was on the 25th of the month of Kislev in the year 3622. And the Second Temple was destroyed on the 9th of Av, 3828. So in fact, from the Hanukkah story to the destruction of the Second Temple was 206 years. Interesting, I've mentioned this point before, and if you ask most Jews which came beforehand, the story of Hanukkah or the story of Purim, not everybody knows the answer. But it's quite clear from our course that the story of Purim took place towards the end of the 70-year exile in Babylon. The story of Hanukkah takes place approximately 200 years into the Second Temple. Tonight we're going to look at about a 100-year period, the period from just the victory of Hanukkah until Herod, which is a period which spans just over 100 years. And next week we'll discuss the events which led to the destruction of the temple and thereafter the dispersion of the Jews, the exile. Tonight for me is a very moving evening, because whilst I was preparing tonight's lecture, I instinctively got the following feeling that the story which we're going to tell this evening is a story of internal strife. Yes, it is pivotal around the centers of power at the time in the Middle East. The political policies and allies to Syria, Rome, who were the military power at the time. But more important than that, what I felt in the preparation of this evening's shiur is that what the Greeks had failed to do to us, we did to ourselves. And therefore, why am I mentioning this at the very beginning? Because history repeats itself, and perhaps we should learn from this period in history and reflect upon the state of the Jew today. Because perhaps, and this is only a suggestion, today we are in what may be called the Third Commonwealth, and the fact that the Jews are back in the land of Israel, there is an internal struggle. We hear of the strife between the Chilonim and the Datiim, the religious and the secular. There is a conflict and battle between the secular courts and the religious courts. And this evening we will listen to a story of internal strife and politics between Jews of different religious beliefs and how it ended in destruction. And perhaps at the very onset we should state or restate that which is said in the Talmud. The Talmud says, "For what reason was the first temple destroyed?" And the Talmud says, because the Jews transgressed the three cardinal sins of idolatry, murder, and immorality. However, the exile was only for 70 years. For what reason was the second temple destroyed? because of the sin of sinas chinam, hatred for no reason, baseless hatred. And for that sin, we have been in exile for close to 2,000 years. A sin much more difficult to rectify. A situation perhaps in some ways mirrored today, although that is a negative point. I, please God, hope to end off this evening by drawing lessons on a more positive note. Let us start with the hero of the Hanukkah story, Yehuda Maccabee. He had on the 25th of Kislev entered into the temple, rededicated the temple, kindled the menorah, and of course we all celebrate even today the miracle of its burning for 8 days. However, we Jews today tend to have the notion that all was hunky-dory after the victory, everything was okay, and the Jews reigned supreme forevermore. Amen. That is not the case. After Yehuda Maccabee had won the battles against the Greeks, there was a false sense of independence within the land. Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the main protagonist in that assault, he died. However, he left a young son called Eupator. And this young regent was in fact too young to rule himself, but he was controlled by two men. One who was called Lysias, was a great general, and the other, a man called Philip, who was an advisor to Antiochus. These two men jousted for power in Syria, and Lysias felt that he could show his dominance by invading Judea, which he did so. He raised a huge army, about 100,000 infantry, 20,000 cavalry, and a tank division, not of centurions, but of elephants. And he marched with this huge army towards Jerusalem, and again, Yehuda Maccabee had to come out and fight, and here we have this amazing story of how one of the sons of the Hasmoneans, a man called Elazar, felt that if he were to kill Eupator, the Greeks would flee the battle. And Elazar felt that Eupator would be stationed on the largest battle elephant. These elephants were huge animals and had on top of them a castle, elephants and castle. And Elazar fought his way through the ranks of the Greeks and stuck his sword into the belly of this huge animal, which fell and rolled over, killing both Elazar and, in fact, its rider. It wasn't, in fact, Eupator who was on the elephant. It was one of the great generals of the Syrians. However, it was a great valiant act, which is recorded in Jewish history, of Elazar. He died in that event. And it showed again and displayed again the great Mesiras Nefesh, the self-sacrifice of all the Hasmoneans. However, this army proved too big for Yehuda Maccabee and his men. And at the 11th hour, just before the Jewish army in fact capitulated, Lysias received news that his opponent Philip had in fact made a coup in Syria. And Lysias therefore made a pact. He drew a quick treaty with Yehuda Maccabee and retreated and went back to Syria. Fortunately, or unfortunately, constant internal conflicts within the powers at the time often had their different effect on the Jews in the land. In this case, there was a coup in Syria. Eupator was killed. Lysias lost power. Philip also went out of the scene. And a new person came on, a man called Demetrius, King Demetrius of Syria. Demetrius again mounted an army and attacked Judea. He was this time supported by the Hellenists in the Jewish camp. The Jews were divided between those who supported the Greeks and their ways, the Hellenists, and the, it's difficult to call them the Orthodox, perhaps I should just call them here the Hasmoneans, those Torah-believing Jews. Yehud, in fact, routed Demetrius's army on the 13th of Adar. One of the great generals of Demetrius at that time was a man called Nicanor. And in fact, it was such an amazing battle, and how Yehuda Maccabee managed to beat him. The day of the 13th of Adar was proclaimed a Yom Tov, and in some circles it's still called Nicanor Day, in the commemoration of the defeat of that general. Yehuda Maccabee made, however, a political mistake, which in fact the rabbis criticize. He was afraid of another and a further Syrian attack, and at this time Rome was already starting to become a political power, and he made a treaty with Rome. There was a certain peace in the land, but it lasted only for 5 years. Again, Demetrius mounted an army, attacked. There was a great battle at a place called Elossa, where, as they had always been, the Jewish army were outnumbered, but this time, in battle, the great Yehuda Maccabee was killed by an enemy arrow, and the power in the land returned back to Syria, and the Hellenists were in control. Yehuda Maccabee himself was buried in Modin, and in fact his burial place, the burial place of all the great Hasmonean kings, became, and even is today, a shrine to which for generations people had visited, and had made it a shrine in the sense that it became the symbol of Jewish opposition of the few in the face of the many. However, the Jews did not give up. There were left Yehuda Maccabee's brothers. There were three of them. One was called Yochanan, the other was called Yonasan, and the other was called Shimon. The Syrians repeatedly tried to subdue the Hasmoneans, but they valiantly fought against them. Constantly, the Hasmoneans valiantly fought against them, and in fact again were successful. The family of the Hasmoneans ruled for about 100 years altogether in Judea. Tonight we're going to follow their descent, so let's start off again with Mattisyahu, the son of Yochanan the high priest, and then Mattisyahu had the five sons: Yehuda Maccabee, Yochanan, Yonas, and Shimon, and Elazar. Already now Yehuda Maccabee and Elazar have been killed. Yochanan died, so you've got two of the original Hasmoneans, of the original sons of Mattisyahu left, Yonasan and Shimon. Let us now focus on Yonasan. Just, if I may also say about the period of the Hasmoneans, it's interesting that we find this whole family was plagued with strife, bloodshed, intrigue, and at the end of the day, although they were famed for their valiant behavior, they were never really successful. In Syria at this time, an imposter came on the scene, a man called Alexander Balas. He made a spurious claim to the throne of Demetrius. He in fact claimed that he was a son of Antiochus. And both Alexander Ballas and Demetrius did a strange thing. They appealed to Jonathan, who was the head of the Maccabees, who was the head of the Hasmoneans in Israel, for his support. Jonathan decided that he is going to play them both off to his advantage, and he returned to Jerusalem. He proclaimed himself, this is Jonathan, the Hasmonean, he proclaimed himself the high priest, and eventually he sided with this Alexander Ballas. And 12 years after the miracle of Hanukkah, again Judea became independent. So in fact, what happened was, if you think from the Hanukkah times, you had Yehuda Maccabee, then Yehuda Maccabee was killed in battle, power returned to the Greeks, and then because of a coup in Syria, again, things changed, and Jonathan, or Jonathan, the Maccabee, again became the head of the Jews, and was now in seat in power. It was under his leadership, under Jonathan's leadership, that in fact the land of Israel was extended, and he almost managed in restoring the land of Israel to its former borders. It wasn't to be for long. One of the Syrian kings, a man called Tryphon, or Tryphon, lured Jonathan to a meeting with him and treacherously murdered Jonathan. Of course, there was one brother still left, Shimon, Simon. He took over, he successfully attacked Tryphon, and he made a pact with the Syrian king. In fact, again, power changed in Syria, and now it was with Demetrius II. And under Shimon's leadership, in fact, Judea did achieve independence. He declared himself the Nossi. Now, let me explain these terms. There are very important terms. Three terms I'd like to explain to you. Nossi, Kohen Gadol, and Melech. Nossi means prince. Kohen Gadol means high priest, and Melech, king. The period of kings of Israel had finished with the destruction of the first temple. There were two kingdoms, the kingdom of Judah, the kingdom of Ephraim. The kingdom of Ephraim was wiped out. The kingdom of Judah was destroyed. There had not been a king in Israel since the destruction of the first temple, which historically was now about 200 years gone. Nobody had declared themselves as the king. And the reason was because Jacob's said in the Bible, Moses had reinforced this position, that Lo Yosur Shevet Miyehuda, that kingship was never to depart, the scepter was not to depart from the tribe of Judah. In fact, it would have been, and was, wrong for a Hasmonean, who was a Kohen from the tribe of Levi, to proclaim himself as king. Technically, it was incorrect. A Kohen God was the high priest. Then the high priest had two functions. Number one, he was the high priest, the head of the Kohanim in the temple, and performed the functions and the ritual of the high priest, both on a daily basis and on particularly on Yom Kippur basis in the temple. But more important than that at that particular time was that the Kohen Gadol served as the spiritual leader of the people. And could therefore be called the Nossi, the president. Not the king, but the president. Shimon declared himself the Nasi. And at this stage, we could perhaps say that the Jews had defended themselves, repelled valiantly the Greeks, and had achieved independence. But, as I said beforehand, what the Greeks failed to do, we did to ourselves. And this is the story of how we did it. Shimon had three sons. Remember Shimon, this is the last one of the actual five sons of Matthew. This Shimon had three sons. One was called Yochanan Hyrcanus, one was called Yehuda, and one was called Matthew. He also had a daughter, and his daughter married a man called Ptolemy. Now this Ptolemy was a bad guy. At his wedding to Shimon's daughter, Shimon had given Ptolemy, he'd made him the ruler of Jericho. And this Ptolemy was a man who was greedy for power. He was a Jew and he was greedy for power. It's not surprising that these names creeped into the Jewish lexicon of names, because at that particular time a whole array of Greek, Egyptian names seeped in because of the assimilation of the times. Now this Ptolemy went to the king of Syria, who at the time was Antiochus, a different Antiochus, and he made a pact with him that Antiochus would invade Judea, and that would be in return for Ptolemy killing Shimon. In other words, if Ptolemy was to murder Shimon, then Antiochus would invade Judea and support Ptolemy as the king. Ptolemy invited Shimon, the leader, and two of his sons, Yehuda and Matthew, to a feast at Jericho. In fact, he wanted the third son of Shimon, Yochanan Hyrcanus, to come as well. For some reason, Yochanan Hyrcanus could not be present at the feast. Shimon thought that this was a familial invitation, went and didn't suspect anything. However, as soon as Shimon, Yehuda, and his two sons, Yehuda and Matthew, arrived at Jericho, they were murdered by the soldiers of Ptolemy. When Yochanan Hyrcanus heard what had happened, he was absolutely furious. His father and two brothers had been murdered by his brother-in-law. And not only that, his mother, Yochanan Hyrcanus' mother, Shimon's wife, had been taken hostage by her son-in-law, Ptolemy. Immediately, Yochanan Hyrcanus assumed power. He wasn't going to be run over by this upstart Ptolemy. The people thought and felt what Ptolemy had done was treacherous and did not support him. He immediately declared himself Nasi and he marched to Jericho. Ptolemy again acted treacherously. Ptolemy held his mother-in-law, Yochanan Hyrcanus' mother, on the ramparts of the city of Jericho, and he threatened that if Yochanan Hyrcanus was to invade, he would murder her. His mother pleaded with her son not to take any notice of this upstart and to come in and kill him, even if it meant her losing her life. However, at that particular point, a threat was heard from Antiochus. In other words, Ptolemy had kept his part of the deal and he had killed Shimon. Antiochus, his forces were moving down to take over Judea, so therefore Yochanan Hyrcanus had to withdraw from his attack against Jericho in order to defend the land. Ptolemy, being the treacherous murderer he was, anyway killed Yochanan Hyrcanus' mother, his mother-in-law, and he fled. And in fact, he fled and was never heard of again. In the meantime, Yochanan Hyrcanus was engaged and became engaged in a year-long battle against the Syrian general and the Syrian king Antiochus. The battle flowed and went for and against, and it was a very undecisive battle. And eventually, Yochanan agreed to make an armistice, a treaty, which wasn't satisfactory, in which he would have to pay a large tax to the Syrian king. But to his favor, instability again in the seat of power in Syria allowed him to cast off that yoke and to proclaim again Judea as independent. And this Yochanan Hyrcanus had two sons. One was called Yehuda Aristobulus, and the other was called Antigonus. And with his two sons leading his army, he in fact was able to repel the Syrians and to enlarge the area of Israel. And he felt sufficiently strong enough not only to enlarge, but in fact to consolidate and to get rid of any of the former enemies. However, he erred in certain matters. One of the ways which he erred is that in the south of Israel, there was a tribe called the Idumeans. Yochanan Hyrcanus went south and he struck the Idumeans. And he did something rather strange to them. He forcibly converted them to Judaism. Now, not often in history do we have forcible conversions. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, tells us today in the laws of Geirus and the laws of conversion that we are not allowed to forcibly convert somebody. And in fact, quite on the contrary, if somebody comes to ask to convert, then we are actively to tell them that we're not looking for converts. We are not a proselytizing nation. Against the will of the rabbis, Yochanan Hyrcanus converted forcibly the Idumeans. And by the way, if I can just sow something in your mind, this little episode turned eventually totally against his favor in generations to come, because eventually an Idumean called Herod was to in fact take power in the land of Israel, as we will study next week, and to cause tremendous devastation. Meanwhile, Yochanan Hyrcanus expanded the borders, and in fact he created a rulership, an independent state, from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. It was almost a recapturing of the biblical land of Israel. And in his days, the state of Israel was independent. It was under his leadership and of those of his two sons. And here we must break off and discuss religious attitudes. Because at this stage in Jewish history, what started to happen was, okay, we had been attacked by Greek influences, by the influences of the Hellenists, and the Hellenists had supported the Greeks. However, the Greek Empire had almost collapsed. It was the Syrians we were dealing with militarily. However, the spiritual threat now no longer came from the Hellenists, it came from within the Jewish camp itself, in the form of three groupings which formed amongst Jews. These three groupings, two of which were large, one relatively small, and eventually fizzled out. Let's talk about the two larger groupings. They were called the Pharisees and the Sadducees. In Hebrew, the Purushim and the Tzedukim. Who were these two groups? If you have a look in Jewish law, in Halacha, you will see that there is a section called Taharos. Taharos meaning the laws of purity. For example, if a man touches a dead body, he becomes ritually impure. In order to enter the Temple Mount, it was necessary to become ritually purified. As we know, that comes through sprinkling of water in which has been placed the ashes of a burnt red heifer. Those who are following the lead up to the M, I don't like to refer it to its real name, but we'll know that there are fanatical groups on many different sides, but I've heard in the Times that there is a Texan farmer who is now importing red heifers to Israel for the big day. Okay, so this group of laws has numerous laws of purity, mainly in reference to temple or to the eating of terumah. Terumah means that if you have a field of wheat or any other grain produce and you separate and tithe an amount from it, that tithe has to be given to a Kohen, and a Kohen has to eat it in ritual purity. Because these laws of purity were kept religiously by the, let's call them the Orthodox Jews, they separated themselves from those who did not keep the laws, and therefore were called Purushim. Purushim means the separate ones, and therefore were known in English as the Pharisees. There was a divergent sect, perhaps, or what's often been called the early reform movement, the early progressive, they didn't call it progressive then, it was a reform movement in the sense that they wanted to reform the Orthodox ideologies. And they were called the Tzedukim. They were called Tzedukim after a man called Tzadok. This Tzadok, he preached the following. He said that rabbinic interpretation of the oral tradition is misled. It is it's rabbinic, it doesn't have a source. The only thing that we must follow is in fact the straight five books of Moses, the written law. Now, the Pharisees believed, as we do today, that the law which was given to Moses on Sinai, two laws were given, the oral tradition and the written tradition, the oral tradition being the interpretation of the written tradition. You can't, in fact, interpret the written law easily or at all in certain circumstances without the oral law. The example I always quote is the mezuzah. It says, "Uchasavtam al mezuzah is beisarcha v'yishorach." You should have a mezuzah on your door. What is a mezuzah? How high is it supposed to be? Which position on the door? Where on the door? What is it written? What is written in it? How do you know unless you have an oral tradition which explains to you the written law? However, the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, they interpreted the law rather more literally, and I'd like to quote to you two examples of law which will highlight to you their policy and how it reflected itself in social mores and law. The first one was, since they interpreted the Bible literally, what are the rules of the Torah is, Lo tzevaru eish b'chol moshesechem b'yom ha-Shabbos. Do not kindle a fire in all your dwelling places on the Sabbath day. That means, literally, we're not allowed to light a flame on Shabbos. However, said the Pharisees, say the Chachamim, the sages, If you light it before Shabbos, it can burn on Shabbos. But you can't light it on Shabbos itself. So therefore, if you wanted to, you could light your gas burner. Not that they had gas burners then, but today we do. You can light your gas cooker before Shabbos, and you can have it burning on Shabbos. That is not a problem. However, the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, said no. You're not allowed to have any flame whatsoever kindle on the Sabbath day, which resulted that they always had cold food on Shabbos. They had only cold food on Shabbos. The sages, in order to refute and to tell the people that they had misinterpreted, ordered the people that they eat something hot on the Shabbos day. And that is the source of us eating today challans on Shabbos. The reason we eat challans or something hot on Shabbos day is in order to refute this notion of the Sadducees that we're not allowed to eat something hot on the Shabbos day. Another example. There is a verse in the Torah, seemingly very strong. It says an eye for an eye. An eye for an eye. The Sadducees interpreted this literally. In their judicial courts, there were many, many more executions, and civil punishments were meted out much easier and much more frequently than in the courts of the Pharisees. The Talmud says that a Sanhedrin who killed somebody once in 70 years was called a bloody Sanhedrin. And yet in the times of the Tzedukim, they killed people quite arbitrarily. In their personal lives, they were much more aligned with the Hellenistic way of thinking than were the Pharisees. They were certainly hedonistic and indulged in the pleasures of life. And the Jewish world sadly split into these two groups. I mentioned a third group. The third group were called the Essenes. Some historians want to suggest that the Essenes were the group upon which early Christianity was based. However, these Essenes, they preached celibacy, they preached that a person was not to own his own property, he was to share it with all others. I suppose, although it's not an exact parallel, one could call it a form of communism. They lived in the mountains, secluded by themselves. They were called in the Talmud Toivle Shacharis, the immersers in the morning, because they were meticulous in about being clean and cleanliness. They wore only white, so they could have been seen like these angelic figures living in the mountains, and they didn't eat meat. They were vegetarians and so on and so forth. I met a person today who lives in Kingston. Had an interesting experience. I was once walking, I decided to take my kids for a walk in Richmond Park, and I wanted to escape all the Jews of South London, and I thought I'll go for a walk in Richmond Park and nobody will find me there. And I was walking down the path and somebody says Shalom. I turned around and this fella tells me a whole long story, but he described himself quite interesting. He's a Jew, lived in Israel for many years and so on and so forth, and when I asked him about his religious affiliation, he said, I know you think it may be quite strange, but I am an Essene. I said, I thought my group died out, years ago. And he said, well, I have historically read about them, and it's to them that I ascribe myself, blah, 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 and so on and so forth. Which was quite interesting to think that those ideas still linger on. But as a group, since they preached celibacy, they in fact petered out. And it was quite a self-destructive group, and only the two, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, in fact continued. May I introduce one more term? zugois. Zugois are couples. A zug is a couple. The golden chain of tradition of the oral Torah in this particular period of history was carried not by one person as it had usually been. Moses gave it over to Joshua, Joshua gave it over to Eli, Eli gave it over to Shmuel, Shmuel gave it over to David, David gave it over to Shlomo, and so on and so forth. The body of tradition was headed at this time by couples. Yossi ben Yezer and Yossi ben Yochanan were the first, and in the times that we're talking about, they were led by two men, one called Yehoshua ben Parachia and the other called Nitai Ha'arbeli. That's important because we will refer to them later. Now, under the leadership of Yochanan, Israel had attained independence, and being in an independent state, so we're not attacked from without, what do? We fight from within. The Jewish country was split ideologically between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The upper classes were dominated by the Sadducees, not surprisingly, because they preached a more, as we mentioned before, in a hedonistic way of life, and it was the in thing to be a Sadducee, and you could have a much easier life than the Pharisees. In fact, Yochanan himself became, towards the end of his life, he himself became a Tzaduki. He became a Sadducee, and his long reign of 31 years ended in somewhat civil strife, in that there being different groupings, and when he died, when Yochanan died, his son, who was called Yehuda Aristobulus, proclaimed himself king even. He wasn't satisfied with the title of Nossi, with the title of prince. He proclaimed himself a king. The rabbis were very much, the Pharisees were very much opposed to this, because they felt that this was a great slight to the Jewish tradition, that only somebody from the kingdom of only somebody from Davidic descent could be a king. By the way, let me just throw something in over here, and that is that this move away from the Davidic descent of kings also aroused a notion by the people that they were waiting for a redeemer from the house of David. So even then, lurking somewhere in the back of the psyche of the Jewish people was the concept of a Mashiach ben David, the concept of a Messiah who was actually going to be of Davidic descent. And that is why we'll come to the birth of Yeshu next week, of Yoshka next week. However, when he came on the scene and he said that I want to restore the Davidic kingdom back to its original place, you can understand somewhat how the people took to that. The Hasmoneans were, of course, Kohanim. Yehuda Aristobulus executed many of the Pharisees. He shared power with a brother called Antigonus, who headed his army. He went on many military campaigns. He annexed the Upper Galilee and again converted many of its residents forcibly to Judaism, again something very much against the rabbi's will. Yehuda Aristobulus emulated Greek and Roman ways, and a mood swing changed amongst the general masses. Although the Jewish people had been so grateful to the Hasmoneans, well, their grandfathers, to Yehuda Maccabee and Matthew originally, for fighting against the Greeks and holding up high Jewish pride, now what had happened, there had been a mood swing, and the people began to oppose, the general masses of people began to oppose the dictatorship of the king Yehuda Aristobulus, who in fact felt, he even executed his brother Antigonus, who had helped him in his military campaigns. The whole story of actually how he did it. He ordered that his guards, that if Antigonus appeared at his palace in full battle equipment, that he be murdered on the spot. And he sent messages. He sent a message that Antigonus should come before him, but he was advised to come with full battle equipment, and he was killed. Anyway, there was an intrigue and a murder. To cut a long story short, this Yehuda Aristobulus, he died sadly, not mourned by the people. He had a wife, however, Yehuda Aristobulus, who was Yochanan's son, had a wife called Shlomis Alexandra. She was also known as by the name Salome, or Queen Shalom Tzion. Shalom Tzion, I suppose that's the name, peace to Zion, Shalom Tzion. In English, Salome or Shlomis Alexandra. Yehuda ben Tabai were the leaders of the Pharisees, and Shimon ben Shetach was a very, very strong character indeed. The Talmud tells many tales of Shimon ben Shetach, one of how he rid 80 witches in one day. There's a fascinating story of how he got rid of many of the witches. These were the third pair of zugos, the third pair of couples who carried the tradition. After Yehuda Aristobulus died, Shlomis Alexandra, his wife, assumed the position of queen. However, since she was a Pharisee, she believed in Torah law, and Torah law stated that if a man dies without having children, then the wife must marry the brother. That's called leveret, marriage, yibum. So she married her late husband's brother, a man called Alexander Yanai. In fact, an older brother. And initially, decrees against the Pharisees were relaxed because Shlomis Alexandra was a Pharisee. It was thought that Alexander Yanai was going to be a harmless character. The opposite turned to be the case. He, in fact, was a ruthless man bent on conquest, and he assumed in a short time full power. His wife Shlomis Alexandra had to, because of the immense ruthlessness of her husband, resign from public life, and he in fact ruled for 27 years. He was bent on conquest. He employed mercenaries from all over the world, particular Idumeans who were great warriors, to go on his campaigns and conquer. Now the rabbis were very much opposed to him as well, this Alexander Yanai, because the Torah says you're allowed to wage two types of war. The first type of war is called Milchemes Mitzvah, a war which is a mitzvah to do. When is it a mitzvah? The word mitzvah means a commandment, which means if the Almighty instructs you to wage the war, the Almighty instructed Joshua to go into the land and wage war against its inhabitants. That's called the Milchemes Mitzvah. The other is, if you are attacked, then of course it's a war of defense. However, to wage wars for self-aggrandizement and conquest is not permitted. What are you allowing people to be killed and kill for? Who allowed you to do such a thing? Alexander Yanai didn't take any notice. He maintained a cruel army. He drained the economic resources of the land. And together with that, he proclaimed himself and was the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, which was the spiritual leader of the country. So you had a fascinating character in this one man, this Alexander Yanai, who on the one hand was and proclaimed himself a high priest, the spiritual leader of the kingdom, and at the same time went on wars. And in fact, in his days, in the 27 years which he reigned, he did manage to expand the land of Israel quite considerably. He hated his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law, his wife Shlomis Alexandra's brother, Shimon Beshetach, the head of the Pharisees, he hated him. And Alexander Yanai uprooted many of the Pharisees from the Sanhedrin of course being the Supreme Court, and he replaced them with Sadducees, with Sadducees. Now this was a very terrible position. It means you had a Supreme Court, right, which was split in its religious and its religious ideology. Now if you have, until that time, you see, let's say if there was a shaila, a question of Jewish law, to whom did people bring their questions? The Supreme Court was the Sanhedrin, and all the members of the Sanhedrin were Pharisees. They all believed in the oral tradition. But if you've got members of the Sanhedrin who were Sadducees, had a different ideology, well, how can you expect such a body to rule on religious issues? So it became more of a civil court, and therefore corrupt and influenced, and more able to influence, political, more open to political influence, which of course is the first stage of undermining any court. The Pharisees responded to all this by not taking any notice of the political issues, but constantly by strengthening the Torah education in the country. And this is, of course, this is why I'm drawing parallels to the present situation. There was a man called Yehoshua ben Gamla, which the Talmud says, had it not been for this man, Torah would have been forgotten from the school children of Israel. Yehoshua ben Gamla introduced a school system. For every child in Israel, there was a place in the school. And in fact, to him it is attributed the first school system. Now, if you think of this, by the way, since then, there has always been an idea of a cheder. Cheder started with Yehoshua ben Gamla. It was not, schooling was not just for the privileged few. It was for everybody. Every single Jewish child had to go and to learn. In fact, the Talmud records a fascinating encounter of Nero. Later we'll learn about him, a Roman, who entered Jerusalem and saw some children in the seat and in the street. And he said to them, Pasuk li pasukeich. Which verse did you learn today in Cheder? He asked three kids and the three children, do you know what we sing after Aleinu, Al Tira Ani Pachad B'Yisrael? And so on and so forth. Sorry, I'm mixing things up, my apologies. That took place in the Mordechai story. These children answered him with verses from the book of Ezekiel and other verses depicting the downfall of any oppressor who would destroy Jerusalem. And in fact, the Talmud records that this Nero, in case that this Nero, there were a number of Neros, a number of people thought that this particular one, when he heard that, realized, he said, God wants me to destroy Jerusalem and then he's going to wipe his hands all over me. Forget it. And he ran away and became a convert. He converted to Judaism, and it says that Reb Meir, one of the famous sages of the Mishnah, was a descendant of Nero. What do we learn from here? Children were learning Tanakh. In fact, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Ben Chomesh Lemikra. A five-year-old child would go into Cheder and study the scriptures till the age of 10. They'd read through Torah, the five books of Moses, Joshua, and all the scriptures. So that by the time they got to the age of 10, they were familiar with all the scriptures. When did that start? That started in the days of Yehoshua ben Gamla for every child. Now, think about it, ladies and gentlemen. When did compulsory education for children start in this country? For all children to read. When did it start? My English history is not as good as my Jewish history. I would venture to say it was only recently, 1870, and here we're talking, this is already 100 years before the destruction of the Second Temple, that compulsory Jewish education was implemented for every single Jewish child. It's not surprising here we call the people a people of the book. Now, an interesting episode. One day, one Sukkot day, Alexander Yanai was serving as a high priest in the temple. There is a beautiful ceremony which takes place in the temple over Sukkot called the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, the celebration of the water libation. Water was drawn in great joy from the pool of Shiloach, Siloam pool, and it was poured out on the altar inside the temple. And the drawing of this water was done with joy, and in fact, the entire night inside the temple, the great and the glorious were danced the entire night. There was great celebration. Even today, over the nights of Sukkot, we have Sukkot parties, in which we, in fact, commemorate this celebration that took place within the temple. Now, it does not say clearly in the five books of Moses that we should have such a ritual. It is something which was a halacha l'moshe m'Sinai, which had been received in the oral tradition. The Sadducees didn't believe in it, but the Pharisees did. Now here you had Alexander Yanai, this ruthless king who was serving in the temple, who in fact was a tzaduki. He was a Sadducee. So what did he do? He drew the water, and to show all the people in the temple that he was a Sadducee, instead of pouring the water out on the altar, he poured it on his feet. The people in the temple were so incensed with him. Of course it was Sukkot, and they were all holding their lulav and esrog, and they pelted Alexander Yanai with the esrogim. They nearly stoned him to death. Well, he got stoned him to death. They citroned him to death with their esrogim. Alexander was so incensed, he just escaped barely with his life, that he ordered his guards to massacre all the people in the temple, all those who had done such a terrible thing. And a terrible civil war erupted, in which 50,000 people died. In the end, Alexander Yanai was so shaken by the Pharisees that he asked the Syrian king, who was at that time Demetrius, to march on Israel with an army to try and help him quell this civil strife. The Syrian king did come, but seeing the odds against him, he disengaged, and Alexander Yanai brutally managed to crush the Pharisees and killed hundreds of them. And of course his brother-in-law Shimon ben Shatach had to go into hiding. Many of the great Pharisees did, although toward the end of his life Alexander Yanai did instruct his wife Shlomis, who was still alive, to make peace with the Pharisees, and in fact suspected both the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He didn't believe in anybody towards the end of his life, and he died a sad old king again, somebody not mourned by anybody. Shlomis, the wise wife that had lived through 27 years of murder, very desperately wanted to introduce a period of healing after her mad husband had died, and she appointed her brother Shimon ben Shatach, the head of the Pharisees, as the head of government. Yehuda ben Tabai, his zug, his twin, or his pair, the head of the Sanhedrin. She restored the Pharisees to charge of the temple, and she ruled for 10 years with great caution, making sure to be politically correct, not to annoy the Tzedukim, not to annoy the Sadducees, but to allow the Pharisees control. So she was, how shall we say, she was a great diplomat, and she is heralded as one of the great queens in her skills in being able to pull together, or to allow to live together, these two opposing ideologies. which you have to be great to do. However, as she aged, even on her deathbed, she had two sons. One was called Hyrcanus, and the other was called Aristobulus. One son, Hyrcanus, was a Pharisee. The other son, Aristobulus, was a Sadducee. Hyrcanus became the high priest. Aristobulus became ambitious. He sided with the Sadducees, and again, that same civil conflict, which the mother had so desperately tried to do some damage control, erupted again, drained Judea, and in fact marked the end of Jewish autonomy in the area. Their forces, the forces of Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, met in battle. They clashed, and it was Aristobulus who emerged victorious. There was, however, do you remember the Idumeans? This nation of the south who had been conquered and forcibly converted. There was one of their ranks, an Idumean called Antipater, who came and supported the weaker Hyrcanus, who was a Pharisee. His intention was that let him take Hyrcanus's army, fight Aristobulus, win, and then depose the weak Hyrcanus and himself become the leader. That was his intention. Antipater urged the defeated Hyrcanus to make a treaty with an Arab king, and in order to do that, he wanted to make a treaty with an Arab king so that there would again be a reinforced clash between the two of them. Now the rabbis, again, they saw this whole civil conflict as purely personal dispute. Great atrocities were done on both sides. The two sons of Shlomis, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, both their armies committed great atrocities. Shimon ben Shattach and Yehuda ben Tabai had died, and the head of the Pharisees were now two men called Shemaiah and Avtalion. Now Shemaiah and Avtalion, if you have a look in the Ethics of the Fathers, teach the following teachings. They say, refrain from public comment and maintain a low profile in government affairs. Well, you can understand why they said that. Because at their time, the two guys who were killing each other were these Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, the two sons of the king, with two different armies, for no apparent reason apart from personal gain. Throughout that political conflict, the rabbis, the Pharisees, continued to pursue, if you want, their sole aim of strengthening Torah values. And you will have heard and know that, of course, the great disciples of Shemaiah and Avtalion were Hillel and Shammai. And we'll make more reference to them, please God, next week. Let us conclude this week with the tragic outcome of the war between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. It got to a head over a siege of Jerusalem, where the forces of Hyrcanus and Antipater were pitted against the forces of Aristobulus, centered on the Temple Mount. Of course, both of them didn't want to disturb the sacrifices that were going on in the temple, and therefore temple sacrifice continued right throughout this period. It was a bit of an anomaly. The whole idea of temple sacrifice is to come closer to God, is to bring peace to the world, and here you have these two brothers go. Anyway, that was irrelevant. It had to continue, the ritual continued, and in fact, Hyrcanus supplied animals to the besieged forces in order that they should be able to continually bring sacrifices on the temple. However, they thought at one stage, this is ridiculous. The whole reason that we're not being able to subdue the enemy is because they've got the sacrifices. But if the sacrifices would stop, then they wouldn't be in favor with God and would be able to subdue them. So a terrible thing. Instead of sending up a cow or a sheep up the pulley to over into the besieged forces, they sent a pig. And the Talmud records this, and it says that when the pig dug its claws into the ramparts of Jerusalem, the entire land of Israel shook with the reverberations. Now, I do not know whether that was a literal, like, earthquake event, or what it in fact meant was the people were shocked to their core that a pig had been sent. The pig, the chaza, which is the trafest of animals, had been sent. The whole notion that you could, the Jews could send a pig to be offered in the temple was so meshuggah that everybody was totally revolted by the conflict. Whilst these two were slogging it out, something else was happening elsewhere which had a major impact on that conflict. And that was coming to full force was the Roman Empire. It is not within the parameters of this course to discuss Roman history, and therefore I'll only make reference to their leaders. But the truth is, one we should, I suppose, devote some time to the study of Rome. We're not going to, but I can only presume that everybody is aware of the events of the successive rulers of Rome, particularly those who've studied the famous English literature, Julius Caesar and so on and so forth. But the first guy to come along was Pompey. And led by Pompey, an army began a conquest of the Middle East. So you had the two Jews, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, killing each other over the Temple Mount, and they go, "Hey, hold on a minute, there's a Roman coming down the road called Pompey." So what did they both do? Both of them decided to send delegations to him that he should adjudicate. Each offered Pompey a greater tax and bribe than the other. What did Pompey do? He was a smart guy. Pompey sided with Hyrcanus. Why? Because he was the weaker of the two. And he felt that once he would subdue Aristobulus, he would take Hyrcanus and he'd use him as a puppet. That's exactly what happened. Pompey took control of all the strategic areas, and Pompey managed to force out or to eliminate most of Aristobulus's forces. However, a fierce battle did ensue on the Temple Mount itself, where the forces of Aristobulus would not give in. It took the Romans that time 2 months to subdue Aristobulus' forces on the Temple Mount. They killed 12,000 in the process, but they left the temple intact. In fact, temple sacrifice continued throughout the period, which was the great anomaly of it. And the result of the conflict was a weak Hyrcanus was put in place as the high priest, with this Idumean Antipater as his governor, and Pompey as the overall strategic control. And Pompey, of course, transfers many of the areas to Rome. Pompey returned to Rome triumphant, and he took Aristobulus with him and paraded him in Rome. He didn't kill him, though. 6 years after that conquest, the Romans started to take apart the infrastructure of Judea. They abolished the Sanhedrin. They divided Judea itself into smaller areas. Again, the Jews felt that they had to do something, as they had done in the times of the Greeks, where they had a leader, Yehuda Maccabee, who had valiantly fought against Antiochus. The Jews felt it is now time to rebel against Rome. Aristobulus had a son, He was called Alexander. He managed to escape from Rome and return to Israel. Immediately upon his arrival, the Jews felt, here is the leader that will fight against the Romans. He organized an army. It was crushed by the Roman forces. Once the Sanhedrin had been disbanded, full power was in the hands of the puppet Hyrcanus, Antipater, his governor, and Rome. There was unrest in Rome, and of course there was the famous conflict between Julius Caesar and Pompey. Julius Caesar sent Aristobulus himself to fight Pompey. We just mentioned that Aristobulus had been taken by Pompey to Rome and paraded. Well, Julius Caesar, the arch enemy of Pompey, took Aristobulus and gave him an army and told him to go and fight Pompey. Unfortunately, on the way, Aristobulus was poisoned by agents and he never got there. But Julius Caesar himself went to battle Pompey and he won. At the last minute, the 11th hour, Hyrcanus, who was the puppet in Jerusalem, switched sides from Pompey to Caesar and helped him overcome Pompey. De facto, what in fact then happened was that full power was transferred to this Idumean Antipater, who had a son called Herod. And this is where we're going to stop this evening. And next week we're going to start with Hurdus, with Herod, who was perhaps the greatest Meshuggah king that ever lived, and wreaked the greatest civil strife and violence, and how that all degenerated eventually into Rome destroying the Second Temple and the Jews exiled.